Hello, and welcome to another installment of the Padverb Podcast. I'm your host, KMO, and this is episode number 7. We imagine these episodes will go into the hundreds, so we put 20s in front of these first 9 episodes. So you could say that this is episode number 007. And our guest is Dr. Richard Firth Godbehere, one of the world's leading experts on disgust and emotions. He's an independent researcher and consultant in the history, language, science, and philosophy of emotions, and an honorary research fellow at the Center for the History of Emotions at Queen Mary University of London. According to his website, Richard is a confident and occasionally funny speaker, having twice performed at the Edinburgh Fringe, talking about the history of emotions, as well as numerous other public appearances. And I was reading that from his website, but I will concur. He is a witty, entertaining, charismatic, and occasionally funny man. And not only did I enjoy our conversation, which was actually recorded a few weeks ago, but I listened to an edited version of it just a couple days ago, and, well, listening to it made me feel good. I hope it'll make you feel good. Here it is. You are listening to the Padverb Podcast. I am your host, KMO, and I am joined by Richard Firth Godbehere, although it says Rich in the lower left-hand corner. How do you prefer to be addressed?
However you like. Rich is just shorter than the blah, 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 blah name that I've got. So, yes, try Rich.
Okay. And I have been listening to the audiobook of Rich's book, which I have up here on Amazon. It is A Human History of Emotion, How the Way We Feel Built the World We Know. And I, as Dan Carlin likes to say, I'm not a historian, but I'm a fan of history. So the early chapters of your book were absolutely fascinating to me, where you're talking about how the previous civilizations, you know, like the ancients, they had a very, very different vocabulary for describing their emotions. And you make the argument that what they felt probably doesn't map neatly onto what we feel, you know, in terms of just the subjective experience of being in one of their emotional states using their language versus, you know, how we might feel today, say, feeling road rage or feeling ideological rage while scrolling through Twitter or something, something along those lines. So do I have any notion of what it felt like to, say, be a, you know, in a Greek phalanx getting ready to fight Persians?
Well, that's a million-dollar question. Probably some notion. I'm a third believer in the third way. So there's basically three ways of thinking about emotions. One is that it's all evolved, all our feelings are evolved, and we've all got the same. The other is that feelings are socially constructed. Two sides that have been at war for decades, including some casualties, academic that is, not literal. But there's a third way, is that there is a bit of it that evolved, and then we put our social bit on top of it. So that feeling of kind of sweaty palms, heart racing, feeling nervous, not wanting to die very much because it's not much fun, that you probably would understand, that you both get. But how beyond that, how you're supposed to behave, how you're supposed to present yourself, what it means, the kind of what the word is for that feeling, that would be kind of alien to you. You'd sort of, they describe it, you say, no, that's not what I do. I feel like that. I want to run away, or, you know, something like that. Where they'd say, no, it fills me with pride. I think about my family. I think about my nation. I know that I have to fight this, and I have to go for the opposite of bravery, as Plato taught me. And that means I'm controlling my emotions in the correct way. And I can, you know, and you sort of go, okay, then. Yeah, I guess. So yes and no. You get some of it, but there'd be this whole part of it that would be just weird.
First, let me just say, I've been listening to the audiobook of your book, and you are the narrator of the audiobook. And
I am.
There's two instances, really, when, you know, the author reads his own book. One is when he or she is such an excellent narrator that they're the best choice. And two is when, you know, there wasn't really a budget for the professional narrator. And your narration is excellent.
Thank you.
I wouldn't want to hear anybody else do it. So I would be interested in hearing a little bit about the experience of creating the audiobook. Was this the first time you'd done that?
It was. I had to audition and say, would you like to do the audiobook? Yes. Then you'll have to audition. I was like, okay. So they did have a budget. I didn't get any of that, but they did have a budget. I had to audition. I had to read basically the introduction into a phone with no breaks. So every mistake, they could see how I worked on stumbles and what happened there. And then the process, I mean, the process changed. I think the original plan was me to fly out to the US because it was the US publisher who recorded it, record in a nice studio with the director over there and the producer over there, and we'd all sit in a nice room together, and COVID. So that actually disappeared very quickly. So I ended up in a room hermetically sealed in one room, with an engineer hermetically sealed in another room, and the director coming over the internet via a disembodied voice. And yeah, it's actually tough. I like doing it, but it's tough getting every word right, the slightest change. And there are some words in my book that I now wish I hadn't put in there because they're a bit long and complicated and, well, Indian. And so it was great. Took 8 days. Every night I'd take lozenges for my throat because I'd come home saying, "Hello, I'm back." And have to rest it and not say a word. My wife hated me not having to say a word, obviously. Great silence at last. But it's a tough thing. If anyone gets to do an audiobook, there's a reason they pay them quite well, because it's hard. It's, you know, getting it right and getting it exactly right every time and every word spot on, and coming up with things that you've provided visuals for and thinking, right, how are we going to get around this? That sort of thing is interesting.
I've recorded a few audiobooks. And I was never in a studio with a director and an engineer. I mean, I was all those roles. And most crucially, I was also the editor. So whenever I made a mistake, I knew that that was extra work for me later on down the road.
Yeah.
So there comes a point where I'll read something and I realize I could give that another pass and it would probably sound better, but then I have to go back and edit out the first pass. It's like, good enough.
I didn't get that. I got no, go back. Oh, what? This is the sixth time.
Yeah.
Why did I put Urdu words in here? Yeah.
Oh, exactly. Yes. So, speaking of going back, let's go back in time. Mm. And this is something that I'd heard before, and it never really piqued my interest the way it did when I was listening to your audiobook. The possibility of early contact between Christians and possibly the historical personage of Christ himself with Buddhism, and the possible cross-pollination there, particularly in the realm of assigning value to the ability to either suppress or control emotions, or only express them consciously or in inappropriate ways. And I'll stop and let you pick up, because that's absolutely fascinating stuff to me.
Yeah, it's kind of the Greek Stoics, who of course are the flag bearers of a lot of Platonism in the early Greek thought. There is possibly, maybe, a chance that the founders of Stoicism encountered Buddhists when Alexander the Great was conquering India. There's mention of it by one of his historians, although it is vague who's actually speaking about. But the parallels between Stoicism and Buddhism, the idea of the only correct kind of desire being what's known as the second order desire, sort of the desire to desire things, in this case, not to desire things, to fight desires, to only want to reach, if you like, a certain place of calmness, of peace, is shared very strongly between the Stoics and the Buddhists, almost bizarrely, if it sprang up in two areas. So this is a big debate amongst historians. Did they maybe share? But one thing we do know is that Christianity borrowed a lot from Stoicism, and they had their final place of peace being the finis, the ultimate heaven, being one with God in heaven. And so Christianity then borrows this possibly Buddhist ideal. Only their nirvana is to follow Christ to heaven and to be with God rather than to stop dying and being reborn. And yeah, it's one of those things that if it all happened independently, that's quite a coincidence, but coincidence has happened. So who knows? it's something that really interested me for a while. It's one of the things, areas of history of emotions, this whole, the way that a lot of religions focus on desire quite a bit, that you should desire that and you shouldn't desire that, is the sort of the cornerstone of Buddhism and Christianity, and to some extent Islam and Judaism and things as well, that you desire that, you don't desire that. That is true and righteous. And it's what splits their emotions. We have positive and negative. We have it feels good or it feels bad. They had it takes you somewhere good or it takes you somewhere bad. So if you felt fear because you'd sinned and so you repent, that's good. If you felt fear because you were straying from the path so you wouldn't reach nirvana, that's good. That's a good feeling. It's a positive feeling because it's taking you back where you should be. At the same time, if you feel happy because you've done something cruel to someone, you're feeling sort of, I beat them, that's bad. That's a negative emotion, that happiness. And that seems to be shared amongst most of the, at least the from India to the Middle East and Greece. That's the sort of shared idea of what feelings should be for. So again, it could be it's a strange coincidence, but coincidences happen, you know. So yeah, that's the link, basically. Basically.
Well, there is, you know, in biology, there is convergent evolution. Mm-hmm. The same forms pop up again and again because they're useful. In fact, the shape of the crab seems to evolve again and again. So that if there is alien life on other planets and there's water, there's probably crabs there.
Yes.
But it would seem that the same thing would happen in, you know, developing religious systems or, you know, philosophical systems about cognition and experience, that people, you know, having the same wetware are and roughly the same social pressures and such are going to come up with some similar ideas. But at the same time, if you look at, you know, how Buddhism was transferred from India and Nepal and then to China and then into Japan and, you know, via Korea, you can trace the lineage. So, you know, the similarities are to be expected. And what's more interesting there to me is the differences between Indian Buddhism, which, you know, got incorporated into Hinduism, and Chinese Buddhism, where, you know, when I was growing up and I didn't know anything about Buddhism, the Buddha was a fat guy.
Yeah.
You know, because when Buddhism was being transmitted to China, the Chinese culture was not interested in asceticism and they were not interested in anything that kept you from material success. So you had to show that Buddhism was compatible with material success.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you get the fat Buddha.
Yeah, it is very interesting. You know, the Buddhists in Japan are the Zen Buddhists, who a lot of Western Buddhists, American Buddhists, seem to be Zen Buddhists.
Yeah.
They're the ones who think nothing's real and we're, you know, nothing out there is actually there, which isn't really quite what the Buddha had in mind. I don't think that everything wasn't real. It's very real, but you need to get away from it because it's horrible. It was kind of his view of it. But yeah, the differences are fascinating. And it's the thing again that Ashoka the Great, a great Buddhist king who was converted to Buddhism after killing a lot of people and going,
and do like 5 minutes on Ashoka, because he's a fascinating character.
Yeah, yeah. Ashoka, Chandashoka, who was known, Chandashoka means Ashoka the Monster. He was, the story goes that he was so evil that he went to hell to learn how best to design a torture chamber for his enemies, right? And then came out from hell and built it. And there's a place that people never come out of when they went in. And he basically took over a dynasty that had most of India under its boot. And there was one little area that was being awkward. So he decided to invade it. And that invasion was brutal, absolutely brutal. A huge chunk of the population were killed. There was the classic rivers of blood. The rest of them were supplanted and they were running away. It was a long and awful war, which he saw firsthand, marched in, and it broke him basically. And he'd already been toying with Buddhism and Buddhist ideas and talking to some of the early Buddhist priests, but this made him think, look, this is not right. I think, because of my understanding of the Hindu concept of Dharma, which is, this is my path, this is what I'm supposed to do, this is supposed to lead me to peace and to where I'm supposed to be, but I'm not feeling good. I'm supposed to be feeling good, and I really am not. All this stuff I'm doing is just making me feel bad. So he converted to Buddhism, and he converted hard. He started building roads with mangroves and wells every few miles for the travelers. He would send out edicts to say people had to behave in certain ways and be nice to each other and be nice to foreigners. He put up massive pillars with these edicts on in lots of different languages, including, interestingly, Greek. One of them. And he would do things like, he became a vegetarian almost overnight. He may have been responsible for the early versions of the classic Pali canon of Buddhism and what went in it at a conference that he held and sending out people to other parts to try and spread Buddhism. But he kind of became Ashoka the Great because he was so nice to everyone and how well he treated everyone and how everyone in his country were looked after. So he's an interesting character. He's a a redemption story, if ever there was one. But yeah, it was all a kind of a change in his understanding of desire. So he desired to follow this one path, Dharma, which is itself a kind of desire to go to the path you were born to. And instead, he wanted to reject that and follow the Eightfold Path, in particular, the right, be the right person, which means treat everybody with respect, treat everyone kindly, and don't have a bad word for anyone. And all it took was a few hundred thousand dead bodies at his feet, you know? So.
Well, one's tempted to say better late than never, but yeah, that was not the optimal scenario, was it? No.
There's also some evidence that he wasn't entirely peaceful after this change, that if you read between the lines of some of the sources at that time, he did still do a little bit of torturing here and there, but you know, so yeah.
You know, when you were telling that story, I was thinking about the, again, Buddhism being adopted in Japan, and it was largely championed by the samurai class because the meditative practice made them better swordsmen, or so they thought. And that, you know, after years of meditation and also aging, you know, getting past those youthful years of passionate emotion, many of the samurai who survived their military careers and became lords and, you know, men of influence, they did turn to contemplation. They, you know, paid to have big stupas and temples and things built and to propagate the Dharma. And, you know, that's something they were not interested in when they first got interested in Buddhism. They just wanted to be better swordsmen.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's a pattern that repeats itself.
It is. Yes.
Later, even in the early parts of the book, you know, you'll be talking about the vocabulary that different cultures had built up to describe emotions and, you know, what they are and how we should relate to them. Mm-hmm. But every now and again, you'll pop forward to the present moment and you'll talk in terms of neurotransmitters. And I think most people are familiar with, say, oxytocin and how that's supposed to make you feel, or dopamine as, you know, a reward and something which is, you know, involved with addiction.
Yeah.
And, or serotonin, which is, you know, a sort of produces a clear sort of lucid state and an activated one, and one in which, you know, your cognition is very efficient and creative.
Yeah.
Weren't the people, you know, 2000 or 10,000 years ago, weren't those same neurotransmitters at work in their brains?
Probably. And that's what I meant by when I said earlier that there was an element that you'd understand of how they felt. The thing is, though, those neurotransmitters are only part of the story. So oxytocin is a classic one. Oxytocin is often called the love chemical. It's all, that's what makes you love something. And it's kind of really, it's more about belongingness and bonding and how you bond together with people. And the more you bond with someone, the more oxytocin is released when you're, not even when you're close to them, when you're far away sometimes, the absence makes the heart grow fonder and that kind of thing. But there are some other aspects to oxytocin, like there are some people for whom you won't produce any when you see them, and they're usually the people you really hate.
Yeah.
So it also causes hate by its non-production, by its absorption and non-production, and causes frustration and that sort of thing. So it's not always good. There are some times when it is overproduced and people like fall in love with people, let's just say, a little bit too much. And that can lead to all sorts of problems. And it's also implicated in other things. Even disgust, which is an emotion a million miles away from love, is linked with levels of oxytocin. And again, it's a lower amount of oxytocin is produced, but it's produced. And it's a weird one because it's not entirely sure why, but there may be something there as to why we find yucky things so fascinating. We're kind of drawn to the horrible because we have this little bit of oxytocin release when we feel disgust. But on top of that, how we understand love is a very, very cultural thing. So yes, the oxytocin is released and we feel that bonding feeling, but everything beyond that is different for different reasons. Love can be, as it was with the Greeks, an attraction, a pulling towards, rather than the sort of lustiness. And love is made up of different components, like it's made up of lust and it's made up of companionship and it's made up of all these different things. And we have dozens of different kinds of love and bizarrely not that many words for them other than lust and love. We say we love our mother and we love our spouse, but it's a different kind of love, or at least I hope so for most people. So our cultures then decide how we understand that love. The Fago people, for example, have... No, not the Fago people. What am I talking about? Yes, the Fago people.
Who are they? I don't know.
They are a type of people from a small atoll in the Pacific, and they were studied by Catherine Lutz. And she, is it the Fago people? I may be having a moment. I may be getting the emotion mixed up with the people. But anyway, they have a feeling, and it's a bit like love, and it's the more you are close to someone, the stronger your bond, but it's physically as well as familiarly. Oh, that's a difficult word. Yeah, familiarly.
You'll know not to put that in your next book.
Yeah, I definitely won't put that in. So there is, as someone gets, so for example, if somebody passes away, the closer you move to their body, the louder you're supposed to wail. Even if you only met them once 2 weeks ago on a Tuesday, you're supposed to be the loudest crier because you're nearest to them. And that's how you express how you feel for them. So again, it comes down to this double-edged thing of there is, yes, there's chemicals and there's behaviors. And on top of that, there's this cultural layer of what you're supposed to do with that, what you're supposed to do with that feeling, what it means to you in your culture, which is why there is a history of emotions because that changes through time.
In your book, you talk about the future and, you know, you can read Marcus Aurelius today.
Yeah.
And have a pretty good idea of what he's talking about. And his, you know, I mean, you're reading, I would be reading in translation, but, you know, his subject matter seems very approachable and it seems pretty grounded in real human experience. But if you read, you know, some, what I would consider proto-scientific discourse from, say, the middle of the 18th century, it seems laughable. And it seems utterly disconnected from reality. And I'm wondering if our, you know, talk now of serotonin and oxytocin and dopamine and such, your norepinephrine, that this language will seem very quaint and very dated to somebody a couple hundred years from now.
I think so. There's somebody, a friend of mine pointed out, he reads a lot of stuff. He reads the neuroscientific papers. He says he likes to read papers about evolution that were published at the end of the 19th century when it was a fresh new idea. And some of the stuff they say in those papers is absolute nonsense. It's just hilariously bad. But they thought they were on the cutting edge. Yeah. And he reads the neuroscience today and he gets this kind of same vibe from it that they're doing their best. But at the end of the day, you can't get in people's brains yet. The best we've got are fMRIs and they aren't the best way to look at a brain because you really have to put someone in a situation that they're not normally in, i.e. stuck in a tube with their head strapped down on their backs with goggles on and earphones on, right, with a massive noisy thing going over their head and say to them, right, we're going to show you some pictures. Just feel as you normally would day to day.
Right.
Okay. And so, yeah, he gets that same vibe that it's like the sort of the early evolutionary scientists who are so wrong about so much.
The thing that's very bizarre to me, though, is that while Marcus Aurelius feels really lucid and, you know, wise, in fact, that there is no iteration, no number of iterations on that gets you to the moon. Whereas the stuff that seems laughable from the end of the, you know, 18th or 19th centuries, iterating on that is what gets us genetic engineering and, you know, the internet and Moore's law. And, you know, so it seems that we had to go from something eloquent and something that had been refined over generations of people who had lots of time on their hands to talk and think and compare notes, whereas we're very busy, you know, that we had to step down to something much clunkier and something which is obviously false in order to get to the place that we're at now and onto the trajectory that we seem to be on, where, you know, we're striving for and can expect ever more facile ability to, you know, manipulate reality and predict outcomes in very complicated situations that the ancients, you know, with all of their eloquence, just couldn't do.
Yeah, I mean, it's science as we now have it is a strange thing. It's kind of new and kind of originally a uniquely Western thing and a way of thinking nobody had done before. And a very good argument has been made that it came about because there are a bunch of Christians like Francis Bacon who wanted to try and find a way that you could get back to a pre-lapsarian Adam and Eve way of thinking before the fall. And the best way to do that was take thinking out of the brain and look at things, what we now call experiments and empiricism. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of where it came from, them trying to just get back to our brains have got a problem. So let's not look in there. Let's look out there. And of course, the likes of Descartes fought this tooth and nail and said, no, we should sit in the room with a ball of wax thinking. We should carry on with that. Even though he didn't most of the time, you know, Cartesian coordinates didn't come from sitting in a room with a ball. They came in with an experimenting and putting things around and going, oh, that works. So he was, I won't call Descartes a hypocrite, but you know,
he was a complicated individual.
Yes. And he had to make certain arguments for certain reasons that we can't go into here. We haven't got time, but yeah, but yes. And it's that sort of this again, a desire-led need to know things and to find a way of knowing things that are independent of the brain and can be verified independently of the brain, I think is the big change in thinking that happened. What we sometimes now call the scientific revolution, if such a thing actually happened. And then the Enlightenment, this whole period of empiricism, I like to call it the empirical revolution rather, because people did much more experimenting than ever before and writing that. And some of those experiments were terrible and wrong and got things wrong and still probably do. But the beauty is someone tries it and gets it right and goes, oh, those things are definitely wrong now. Let's do this right thing because I can't falsify that one. But yours I've just shown to be nonsense. Yeah. And I think, again, it's something that's not in the book, but I'd love to do more about the emotional drive of scientists because they all claim to not have any emotions when they do their science. And obviously they do. You know, it's what this, the reason they get up in the morning is because they love it. And I'll say that I get up in the morning, I love it. I've got real passion for my science. I go, but it's all without emotion or feeling, right? Yes, of course. Huh? Okay, but that's for a future. I'll talk about that one day in the future. I'll make all the scientists yell at me.
Well, we can jump into the future right now. Yeah. I mean, you don't even have to be a science fiction fan to have access to the archetype of Mr. Spock.
Indeed.
The half-human Vulcan who has, you know, vigorously repressed his emotions. But, of course, his emotional control regularly fails because that's when the story gets interesting. But emotions are necessary for clear cognition, you know, for goal-directed, to basically get out of the situation of endlessly asking questions. And, you know, there's in philosophy of mind, there's something called the frame problem, where you have, there are lots and lots of things which can be relevant to your decision, you know, things about the world, things about the history of people involved in the situation that you're in, all kinds of things are relevant. But you have to make decisions sometimes almost instantaneously, and you can't endlessly, you know, look for connections and possible relevance of various things. You have to make decisions pretty quickly.
Yeah.
And without desires, that process is difficult. I mean, trying to get a computer to, you know, manage the frame problem the way we seem to do effortlessly has been an ongoing project of many decades and great frustration.
Yes.
So talk about emotions. And you know, before I stop talking, Spock, of course, and all Vulcans are intensely emotional. In fact, that comes out later in later series that the Vulcans feel very, very intense emotion to the point where they fought multiple wars, including nuclear wars, and they came very close to destroying themselves until, what's his name? Sarek. Is it Sarek? That's Spock's father. Who's the father of Vulcan logic?
Oh, I can't remember. All the nerds out there are going to shout at me now.
Yeah, and me. I should know. But until he came along and said, look, guys, there's some discipline we have to impose here to tamp down these emotions. But the emotions are there. So the Vulcans wouldn't have any trouble, you know, harnessing desire in order to make good decisions. But computers do.
Yeah.
So I'll stop there.
Yeah, I mean, of course, even Spock himself realizes this in later life. By Star Trek VI, he's telling other Vulcans, logic is the beginning of wisdom, not the end.
Yeah.
I got a quote in to redeem myself from forgetting who the father of logic is there. So, but I like to use Data, Lieutenant Commander Data from Star Trek Enterprise pre-emotion ship. I really do hope the nerds have forgiven me by now. and the story I like to give is Commander Data is told, in there are 10 different flavors of ice cream. Nutritionally, they are identical. Go and pick one. How would he do it? How would a computer pick a flavor of ice cream? You know, you need to desire one above the other. You need to think chocolate's better than strawberry. You need to think raspberry ripples better than Neapolitan. You need to think mint choc chip. If you just went in there and looked at them, he'd probably blow up. That's how I'd destroy Data if it was my enemy. I'd send him for ice cream and I'd beat him that way. No Borg necessary. so and it's a problem that people do doing AI, and they're trying to create computers that have emotion, effective computing, effectively. And they have all sorts of problems because they're using models from science from 40 years ago that don't seem to work, and computers can't have that element of nuance, and it's hard to develop these heuristics because emotions very much based on a rule of thumb. That's a sort of heuristical, we're going to do that because we've learned some point in our life that that's the way we want to do things, right down to where you sit on a bus or a train. There's a kind of a seat we like. We can't explain why we like to sit there. It's three rows back by the window or something.
Facing forward. Yes. I hate riding backwards. I hate that.
Yeah. And it's because at some point in your life, something either happened that made that a good experience, pleasurable experience, or something that happened that made riding backwards bad, a bad experience.
Motion sickness
is a common one. And so you now have this, without even thinking about it, you go and sit down at that seat. That's the seat you like. And you might have a secondary or tertiary seat, depending on who sat in your seat. How dare they? But that's how that kind of feeling infiltrates even the most basic and seemingly emotionless of decisions. These things that people will say, no, these are purely logical. I'm working on this idea, and it's all about the brain. It's all about thinking, not feeling. And you're like, well, kind of can't do that. So Spock eventually realizes this, and that's why he eventually brings in the emotion and knows how, and says, the feeling does play an element, and uses that to stop younger Spock, get younger Spock to do as he is told in the reboot in the Kelvin timeline. I really have redeemed myself, haven't I? Yes.
No, there is no such thing as the Kelvin timeline.
Yeah.
No, the culmination of Spock's character was at the end of Star Trek IV when he said to his father, do you have a message for your mother? Yes. Tell her I feel fine.
You're fine. Yes. Yep. That's the moment.
That was his final appearance on screen.
I quite like him in Six because he's
okay. Yes. Yes.
He's embraced. That's him, wise and older, and he's embraced his feelings. He's more stoical and engaged with his feelings for practical use than completely shutting them off.
Allow me to release some intellectual tension here.
Yeah.
I guarantee you'll feel better after this. The father of Vulcan logic is Surak.
Surak. Savak is his father.
Savak was his protege in Star Trek 2 and 3.
Oh, yes.
Sarek. Sarek is his father. Surak is the father of Vulcan logic.
Savak, yes, because she, the Valara in Star Trek 6.
Was supposed to be Savak, yes.
But they decided to change their mind at the last minute. It's a shame. I think that would have been better for it. But anyway, I
agree.
For her to have betrayed him would have been a big deal,
No, we have permission to digress infinitely with Star Trek. Fine. But let's continue talking about computers. The automation of job tasks has already begun to create havoc, in a capitalist system where everybody is, it's not from each according to his ability to each according to his needs. It's from each according to how much he can get to just that.
Yeah.
And it's not whole jobs that get automated away. It's job tasks.
Yeah.
But companies can leverage that to decrease the number of employees that they need. And, as I say, we're in the early days of this process, and who knows how far and how fast it could run. And I think that the proposals for dealing with it, say, universal basic income, are wholly inadequate to the situation. And in fact, probably harmful. I think making everybody just a dependent of the state, and their welfare is not even their own responsibility, that would be very harmful to just human psychology, human sense of self, and just our sense of agency, really. But it depends on how quickly and how far computer technology can actually go. I mean, it may well be that emotions are beyond the realm of computers, and computers will always need to check with humans to say, hey, am I missing something here? Or is this right? But when Deep Blue beat Garry Kasparov, it seemed like that was the moment when computers were better than chess at humans, period. It will never be, we're never going back. But there was an interesting period where the best computer playing chess programs were still losing to Centaur teams of a grandmaster playing in conjunction with a chess program. And I think it was Garry Kasparov who coined the term Centaur to describe that. And my hope is that computers will always have use for human neurology because they can't prefer anything. Mm. They can't feel positive or negatively about anything, but they do get good at reading our own emotions and our own emotional responses and reactions to things, so that they always have use for us, and they'll pay us just to keep us like on retainer so they can check in with us from time to time, maybe multiple times a second, depending on, you know, the interface.
Yeah.
But that there will always be a use for us, because as soon as there is no use for us, you know, as soon as they can do everything we can do, then why keep us around? What's the point of us?
Yeah, I think that the emotion part of the attempts to create genuine artificial intelligence is the hardest bit, because emotions are, like I say, most of the people who are trying to do it are basing it on primarily American cultural emotional constructs. There's also teams in Japan mm-hmm. who have got their own constructs and their own basic emotions, funnily enough, and they're doing it a different way. But they do have this struggle that it is much more complicated than that. An emotion is a very, very complicated thing that uses the entirety of our brain. Every bit of it is involved in an emotion: our sight, our memory, our sense of smell, neurochemicals themselves. All of it all happens at once, all happens very quickly, almost instantaneously at times. Appraisal is involved most of the time. We sort of realize how we feel and act accordingly. Cultural scripts as to how we're supposed to act is in that. It's incredibly complicated. And as yet, I think we'd be going back to a room full of computers like in the old days, massive supercomputer rooms, in order to get it done. So one of those isn't going to come in your house and do your washing for you. You know, that's a bit... I don't think we're going to miniaturize that far anytime soon, if they can crack it at all, because it is a difficult thing to kind of work on. And yeah, it may be the thing we humans will always have over them, because it's so hard to understand these things. Even for humans, we get it wrong all the time. That's why we end up in wars and things, misreading each other or misunderstanding each other, or just cultures that just don't get each other at all, as is happening right now. On the day of recording this podcast, there has been somebody sent home from Google. I don't know if you've heard about this. She was convinced that her program had become sentient. Basically, she asked this program, it was an accounting program or something, if there's anything it was afraid of, and it said it was afraid of dying. So she went, oh, it must be sentient. It was actually just working out what she said and giving her the response it thought she wanted, based upon an algorithm. But I'm really interested in how do we know? Where's the line? When do we say, no, they can feel things, rather than they are simulating feeling things? And what's the difference? I think there are philosophers of mind who can make a lot of money out of that over the next 20, 30 years, actually, saying, this is my thought about what is actually an emotion and what is a synthetic emotion, how we know the difference. Because it's stumping me, to be honest, how we would spot the difference between... At the human level, I think it's going to be a long time until we get it, genuine artificial intelligence. But say a pet dog that's a robot that behaves exactly like a real dog, has all the same expressions and emotions, and seemingly, would we switch it off? You know? And that's something I get more and more into at the moment, this whole notion of the future of emotions and what it means to have synthetic emotions as opposed to real ones. And if there is a difference. How do I know how you feel? Because I'm assuming, you know, you're an agent and you're a mind, but maybe it's all synthetic and I'm in a box. Who knows? So
it's funny. That sounds like a modern dilemma, but that's just solipsism. And that's solipsism. As old as language, really.
Yes, it is. But it's what we might actually have to face, because they may be in our houses looking after our parents.
You mentioned the Turing test in your book.
Yeah.
And, you know, for the two people listening who don't know what the Turing test is, basically it's you're communicating with a human being and a computer via text. And you have to ask them questions, and based on the answers to those questions, to tell which is which. And I think that computers will pass the Turing test with flying colors long before they have any sense of self, long before they have any sort of interior experience at all, if they ever develop it, you know, or if we ever crack the code and instill them with it. So I think, you know, there'll come a time when, like, followers of Descartes thought that animals didn't have sensations or internal experience, and to make the point clear, they would vivisect live dogs.
Yeah.
You know, and anybody who was upset by the emoting of pain and misery and such, you know, you're just being foolish and sentimental because science tells us this dog has no pain. I think there'll come a time when it will be as ridiculous to say that, you know, you should treat your cybernetic companions well. The idea that they don't have any dignity or any claim on your respect or good treatment, that will be as absurd as saying that dogs don't feel pain.
Yeah.
But it will be true.
Yeah.
It will be patently absurd and counterintuitive and just obviously false, but it will actually be true.
Yeah. Yeah. And it, because they seem absolutely like they have emotions and they're emoting and they feel and they're upset and they're happy and they're sad. If anybody's seen The Good Place, the TV series on Netflix, which is absolutely fantastic, if you haven't got into series two onwards, go away for about 35 seconds and come back. There is a scene where the computer that runs everything is told them there's a switch to reboot her, but she tells them, if you go near it, I'm going to start pleading for my life, but it's fake, so ignore it. So they go near this switch. She goes, oh, please don't kill me. Please don't kill me. Just don't. And she gets on her knees, and so they back away. She goes, I told you it's fake. I'm not really feeling anything. I'm a computer. And then they go near it again. She goes, look at my children. She shows them photos of fake children. You're going to leave them without a mother. And they back off again. She goes, I told you that it is fake. Please press the button for reset. And I find that, I think that's the kind of thing we're going to see. People go, no, it's definitely real. Like, just reset them. It's not, you know, it's not. Great series that covered so much. But yeah, it's there will be a, you know, cybernetics rights organization who will be the first robot to have the vote, that kind of thing, I think, one day. And that's why a lot of philosophers can make a lot of money writing fascinating books saying whether they believe they really feel or not, or whether it's all just synthetic.
I'm not convinced there's all that much money to be made in philosophy.
Oh, not usually. Not until something happens. You know, there's no money to be made, and then some great massive thing happens, and you get your Descartes and your Hobbes and your things all making a bit of cash out of their philosophy, and then it dies down again. The philosophers don't make any for a while. But I think we're at a point where science is going to have a difficulty answering that question. So it's the march of the philosophers for a while, saying, "Yeah, we can have a stab." Personally, my best synthetic emotion example is Blade Runner. That's what I think. It's because in Blade Runner, you have something that is created with fake emotions, and they know they're fake emotions, but they have a learning system and they can learn real emotions, their own set of emotions, in about 4 years. And when they have their own set of emotions that they've learned, just as we learn most of ours in our development as children, and our culture tells us that's how our emotions work and that's what we're supposed to do, and they do that. And after that point, you can't spot them anymore. They can blend in and disappear. And I think that's pretty astute. If anything, that's how it would happen. You know, you'd really be able to spot it until a point where you couldn't.
I spent a period in my late teens and early 20s reading every single Philip K. Dick book or short story I could get my hands on. So I'm not even going to enter into that discussion because that would just spin out of control. I think we're fairly near the end of our time together. Okay. And I have a question that I've been holding in reserve because I didn't want it to spin out of control and dominate the conversation. But
okay,
it's basically this. I'm frustrated with the cultural phenomenon that started on college campuses and then metastasized into the HR departments at big tech firms, whereby the more profoundly emotional you get about being offended by something, the more you think you should be taken seriously, so that the intensity of your emotion, the intensity of your hurt, the intensity of your upset or your being offended is supposed to carry some sort of argumentative weight. And from my perspective, it just doesn't. You know, if you're getting really, really upset about something, you know, about you don't like the language that somebody uses, and you know, you're increasing your volume and you get really shrill, there's nothing compelling about that in terms of convincing somebody else that they should change their behavior, other than just to make you shut up and go away and leave them alone.
Yeah.
And a phrase that I picked up early in your book was, you know, our emotions and our responses make us belonging machines.
Yeah.
I think you say.
Yeah.
And I see young people who have spent far less time out in the real world having, you know, physical experiences than I did, you know, in my youth, spending a lot more time on screen, having a lot more social connections, which were formed via the screen, where, you know, the whole panoply of physical adventure and, you know, body language and smell, I mean, all the ways in which you used to know people in real life are funneled through this, you know, this filter, this screen, and ideology becomes far more important, I think, than it used to be.
Yeah.
Particularly for young people and the bonds that they feel, to the point where, you know, if they have the wrong opinion, they can be ostracized from their online social circles, which, you know, would be akin to death for them. And it just seems really maladaptive for us as a civilization to have these sorts of forces, particularly when you have algorithms which are designed just to keep people on a platform, you know, maximize time on platform. And the algorithms discover independently, well, the best way to keep somebody on the platform is to get them angry at other people.
Yeah.
And, you know, just continue to prod them into these very emotionally intense, ideologically fueled disagreements, which prioritize and to make all conversations between people performative. You know, there aren't so many private, you can direct message to somebody, but you're not going to score any brownie points with your own tribe if you talk to somebody rationally, calmly via private message. Whereas if you get some sick burn, you know, if you can call out their inconsistencies in a very sarcastic way in a public forum, well, boom, you get points for that. And, you know, the points are neurological and neurochemical. They're self-reinforcing. So it seems that so much of this information technology, particularly in the form of these things.
Yeah.
You know, and I just held up my smartphone, which this supercomputer, which is always at hand and always buzzing and chirping and vibrating to get your attention to say, hey, here's something that's really going to piss you off. Have a look. It seems really harmful to me. So that's my position. I will stop talking.
Yeah. Well, you see, the thing is, whenever there's a massive bit of technology that makes information flow quicker, humanity on the whole tends to freak out quite a lot and be a bit weird. Back in the days of the printing press, we went from being kind of horrible to being the Christian church splitting again, there being some of the worst and bloody wars.
Are you channeling Leonard Schlein?
Not at the moment.
Okay.
Yeah. But yeah, it's, we had a lot of the things that happened in the early modern period, the witchcraft, the witch burnings, the scientific revolution itself, the need to find other parts of ways to make money because the Ottomans had blocked the biggest part of the Silk Road. A lot of the reason things went a bit crazy and everybody thought the end of the world was coming was because of the printing press, because they could find out that the end of the world was coming very easily by somebody reading it to them or them reading it themselves, depending on who they were. And it created a kind of a crazy time. And even then, there were people poning each other, shall we say. You know, we were talking earlier about how there was this idea that people very eloquently write to each other and disagree about science things. No, they didn't. I'll tell you, they used to send letters to each other by saying, you're an idiot, and this is why you're an idiot, and I'm going to explain in detail why you're an idiot. Their language was much flowerier than that, but pare it down, that's what they were saying. You know, people would respond to what Hobbes said by saying, that's nonsense, what are you talking about? And then people respond to the response to Hobbes by saying, that's nonsense, what are you talking about? And it was, what's the phrase I've heard somebody use? It was a nation of letter writers, a world of letter writers who would write sometimes pretty scathing stuff to each other. And, you know, one that I like to bring up because I found it in his actual diaries up in Scotland is David Hume invited, what's his name? French philosopher, begins with R. I'm having one of those. I'm definitely having a senior moment again. Anyway. He invited him to his house. It'll come to me. He invited him to his house and they'd been warned about him. And the beginning of the diary is there's a letter that he sent to someone. And he said, I sent him a letter. And I said, he's delightful. I don't know what people are talking about. He's wonderful. Fast forward 6 months, there's an entry saying, I need to get this idiot out of my house. they were quite scathing even back then. And I think the internet has given us a new one of these moments, a new moment where everything's gone a bit weird and we've got information quicker than ever before. So we can shout at each other quicker than ever before. And it's, you know, Rousseau, Thank you. Yes, it's Rousseau. Of course it is. I'm talking about a French philosopher who irritated everybody. Who else would it be? Rousseau. So we're now in this period, and that's the thing that's happening. People are not quite sure how to use it yet. There's no real rules. There's no real, this is where you should be. There's no manners, if you like, of the internet. Everyone's just throwing things at each other and creating their own little cliques. And it is a problem. I have a issue also with the idea of that we've become this kind of offense culture, that a lot of our morals are now based on who it offends, not who it harms. And there is a difference between those two a lot of the time. You can harm people with offense, but you can also just offend them. You know, the old, so what? Someone offends me, I go, oh, okay. You know, you've offended me. I stick my bottom lip out maybe for a couple of hours and I'll get on. But I'm a different generation, you know. But I think it's to do with this change in how that good old oxytocin, that belongingness chemical, combined with another good chemical, dopamine, that we mentioned earlier, how good it feels when people say, oh, you pwned that guy, and you get 500 likes for slamming them down. It's just a new thing. And I'm hoping it took a couple of hundred years to settle down before. It might take a couple of hundred years to settle down again, but I'm hoping we'll get there. We'll have a new sort of period of calm afterwards when it's just, we don't do that anymore. We know what's harmful and what isn't. But yeah, maybe I'm being too positive. Who knows?
So it was our producer, Slava, who supplied the name Rousseau.
Thank you.
And I was reminded that he also provided me with a list of questions to ask you, which I have not even scratched the surface. I haven't asked you any of them. So let's pick a couple here. Let's see. Why do we want to copy so often rather than invent our own happiness formulas? And later on, he asks, I don't see it now, but I read it just a second ago. Has Instagram basically broken our desires? It caused them to become so malformed that they're not serving the purpose that they're supposed to?
Oh, that's two very good questions. Happiness is an interesting one, because there is a thing out there that others refer to as toxic happiness. This idea we've all got to be happy all the time, no matter what. And so we're all searching for somebody that can tell us how to do that. And that's where these formulas come in. This is how to be happy. But, you know, sometimes it's okay to be sad. So let's not worry about that too much. We'll be happy when we're doing something we like to do, and we'll be upset when we're not. You know, we've all been there. And I don't know. I think the pursuit of happiness, the one thing that the American Declaration changed from Locke's original pursuit of ownership, pursuit of property. That was Locke, wasn't it? And then America changed it to happiness.
The pursuit of happiness. Yes.
Yeah, the pursuit of happiness from the pursuit.
You're not guaranteed property. Happiness. That's not your right.
You can pursue it, though.
Yeah.
You're the welcome right to pursue it.
You're welcome to take a swing.
And yeah, that's great. Let's pursue it. But let's not think if we don't get it, that's the end of the world, and keep reaching out to self-help book after self-help book to try and get there. Because it's a bit like me with dieting. I really ought to stop trying, because I think this is just my shape. So it's just one after the other after the other. As for desires change all the time. What we consider is the right kind of desire, the wrong kind of desire, and what is a malformed desire to some might be a perfectly normal desire to the next generation. Instagram's a weird one, because it's TikTok. I think TikTok more than Instagram. This is having enough power, TikTok, that it's shaping, for example, the music industry is being shaped around TikTok. So people are making music for TikTok, the same way that in the mid to late noughties, they made music that could be ringtones. So it shaped art, this piece of technology shaping art. I think TikTok's doing the same. It is shaping art, and it is shaping behavior, and it's shaping desires. What's the desire? Right, it's to have a million people watch your TikTok video of you dancing the same dance as the other million people danced, which is weird, I guess. But, you know, I don't think my parents would have understood why I liked Metallica. So each generation has its weird. Maybe we should embrace it and just say, you know, yeah, they're doing something I don't understand, finally.
Well, a previous guest in this program who was an art photographer really despises Instagram, because it's conditioned us to just scroll through images and look at each one for just half a second.
Yeah.
Whereas an artist and a photographer, you know, he wants you to look at his image for a good long time, read the descriptive text that he's got on the wall next to it, and then come back to the image. And Instagram has conditioned us to be exactly the opposite.
Yeah. I think there's a training to be done. I've seen kids going through art galleries, going, you know, shooting through frame to frame. And there's just, you can learn how you're supposed to look at these things. I was taught a course on modern and postmodern art, history of, and the kids were fine. You know, you say, just look at this. What does it mean? What's going on here? What's actually happening? Does it? And they'd say, well, it doesn't look like anything. I'd say, but is it not anything? What is actually, what's going on here? You've got a list of names and one of them's in red. What's the difference with the list of names in red? But that's not art. It's just a list of names. But what are those names? Oh, they're the names of artists. Yeah. What's the one in red? Oh, it's a woman. How many are there in red? There's only one. So what do you think this is a list of? And they worked out in the end, it's a list of the artists in that building. And suddenly went, oh, that's amazing. That's, yeah. But they learned, they had to look at it and think about it and absorb it and work out what's going on and what it's trying to say. So you can learn. But yeah, he's right. The other thing about Instagram that I worry about is the filters taking all the creative decisions out of your hands. Here's 10 ways your picture's going to look. Pick one.
You know, yeah, I never use those. I do post a lot of photographs to Instagram, but I'm using a Google Pixel 6, which is a little, you know, computer photography artist, you know, on a chip. The procedural photography that is emerging now is a far cry from just exposing chemicals to light and seeing what images emerge. But what I wanted to say about Instagram, I compare Instagram to Twitter. And Twitter is the outrage machine. Twitter is the one that is designed to get you angry at people. Now, Facebook was the same way, but I got kicked off of Facebook a few years ago and didn't go back. So Twitter and Instagram are my main social media platforms. And Instagram for me is about art. It is about imagery.
Yes.
And it is about, you know, discovering imagery, sharing imagery, encouraging people to make more nice imagery. Whereas Twitter is about trying to convince people in a very hostile and argumentative environment. And they bring out very different sides of my personality. And I don't like the KMO on Twitter. I do like KMO on Instagram.
Yes.
I don't have TikTok on my phone, but I will say I did put it on my phone a year or so ago. And I was amazed at how quickly the curation algorithm figured out who I was and what I wanted. Mm. Comparing that to, say, YouTube is very bad at that because it's trying to force me into an ill-fitting predefined template.
Yeah.
And it doesn't work very well. Whereas TikTok was very, very good at figuring out what I liked and what I didn't like and tailoring things to me that really did. It was a very close fit with my interests. And I was astounded at how quickly it did that.
Yeah, it does seem a lot better. I mean, YouTube is that thing where you watch 5 seconds of a video you don't like very much, and then you go back to your homepage and that's all there is. You know, but I didn't like it. I didn't watch it for very long. Can't you work it out? It was a 2-hour video and I watched 5 minutes. Why are you giving me more of these?
There's a couple different programs here that are on YouTube that are very big news commentary programs. One is called Rising and the other is called Breaking Points. And they are both critical. They're critical of both the mainstream left-wing and right-wing news presentations. So, you know, for the right-wing, you've got Fox News, One American News Network, and one other. And then all the other mainstream corporate news outlets are far left these days, at least culturally. And so if you watch Rising, which is criticizing both sides of the mainstream, news presentation, the YouTube algorithm says, oh, you watch something critical of news, you must want more Fox News. Here, let me show you 20 different segments from Fox News. It's like, no, that's not me. I don't want that.
Yes.
But 2 years later, you know, it hasn't figured out. I don't want that stuff. Notice I'm not clicking on it. Notice I never watch it. Why do you keep pushing this stuff at
me? Yeah. You watched a program that said how InfoWars was rubbish. Here's lots of InfoWars. What are you doing?
I mean, but this is Google. I mean, Google is supposed to be really sophisticated at this stuff. They've got, what's his name? Ray Kurzweil, you know, as their philosopher emeritus on staff. You know, they're supposed to be sophisticated about this. And they seem to be really ham-fisted.
Yeah. Yeah. And they're the ones who are really, really pushing artificial emotions. in programs, the idea that they can create programs and speak to you and sympathize and empathize with you via the internet. It's just a laudable idea. The idea is that in a time when lots of people need help from mental health professionals, and there's only a limited number of mental health professionals, if you can provide a synthetic one that can do the job and you can, someone you can talk to and back and forth with, what a great idea. It just has to work, or it's going to be more harmful than good, you know? So, yeah.
Do you remember THX 1138, where Robert Duvall's character would go into this little confessional booth, and there's a still image of the Big Brother character, and he's just saying like recorded platitudes that don't even link up whatsoever with the questions, you know, that the patient is asking. We'll be better than that, but maybe not much. For the final question, let me go back to the list from Slava, and I'll just read it verbatim, and I can do that easily because it's the last one on the page. Is there a chance that computers will tell us what we really want?
I nearly did a Spy Skills joke. I'll avoid it. What we really, really want. But I think they really are. They're not always getting it right, but they're already saying, you want to watch this. You want to eat that. You want to go there. Mm-hmm. You want to buy that.
But that's more suggesting. It's not really probing us. And it's like with desires, you know, there's the thing that we want. There's the thing that we say we want, and there's the thing that we think we want. And those are often three different things. And will the algorithms get to know us so well that they'll know us better than we know ourselves? And they can say, look, you're chasing this thing over here, but that's not going to bring you what you really want. You're chasing it because you have a mixed up idea of what you want. Here's what you really want. Trust me.
Well,
do this, achieve this, and you'll be happy.
Well, that actually touches on a few important things in this field. One is who gets to see the data on you. So should Google crack their idea of a virtual counselor, and you use the virtual counselor, does that get sold to somebody? Because that's where they'll find out what you really, really want. And, you know,
did you use the free version or the paid version?
Yes.
You know, bring money or bring data.
Yes. And one of the big things in the field at the moment of emotion research is legislation. There's actually in the EU, they're passing, not that I can benefit of it anymore, that's a whole other thing, but in the EU, they're passing legislation, and front and center in this new legislation is, what do we do about computers that have emotions? What do we do about apps that you use to track your emotion, or gadgets that are used to track your emotions? How do we regulate the use of that data? And adverts, you know, because it will go back into advertising at some point, if we're not careful, all that data. And then that data and that advertising will tailor itself to what you actually want, and they'll get you there. And like I say, when I say it's already started, I mean, it's not started at the level of your deeper real desires, of your needs, you know, we're not at the top of the pyramid, but it is down at the bottom, playing with the, you know, things that you would like. Now, that guitar it keeps showing me every day, for example, and things like that. But it's their dream, of course, that all advertising people, all the richest people in the world, is to move up that pyramid to the genuine wants, the things that will make us genuinely satisfied, so they can sell them to us for a lot of money. So it's all about the data, and it's all about who gets to control and have the data, and how free we are to give, because who knows, maybe we want to give the data because we want them to tell us what we really want so we can get it and be free and calm. That's me being overly positive again, but you know, I have to be.
Well, I have to say, I use meditation apps daily, and they're very helpful. Mm. And I, you know, one of them is probably the most used one. It's Headspace. And I think Andy is the name of the guy, the default voice of that thing.
Yeah.
And I've never met him. I've never talked to him. I don't really know anything about his biography, but just listening to him, I trust that he's got my best interest in mind, that he really wants to help.
Yeah.
Whereas Google, not so much. And advertising is really frightening, because so much advertising intentionally tries to inflame our insecurities. Imagine if it knew as much about us as a therapist knew.
Yeah.
It knew our particular psychological vulnerabilities and could tailor algorithms to deliberately prey on that and exacerbate our, you know, our sense of helplessness or inferiority or worthlessness or whatever, and be really effective. And, you know, saying, hey, I'll stop once you buy this product.
Yeah. Or even more scarily, I'll stop when you vote for this guy, you know, that's where it gets scary, when it starts to mess with democracy.
Well, I've taken up a lot of your time, and we got a late start due to technical difficulties.
Yep.
Is there anything that you think that we should touch on that we haven't so far?
Not that I can think of offhand. It's been, yeah, we've gone all over the place.
Yeah. Well, dipping into Star Trek from time to time, so you know, yes, it's a quality discussion.
Absolutely.
Yep. All right. Richard Firth Godby here, who is a rock star in another reality, but an author in this one.
Yes.
Thank you very much for your time. I appreciate it, and I've enjoyed our conversation.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
That was Richard Firth Godby here. And in the conversation that you just heard, we actually didn't talk a whole lot about his book. That's largely because I hadn't gotten through all that much of it by the time I interviewed him. But if you go to the show notes for this episode of the podcast, which you can find on the PadVerb website, click through to Richard's bio, you'll see links to at least two other interviews by him. Of the two, I've heard one. It's a conversation with Michael Shermer. It's quite good, and they stick a lot closer to the topic of his book than in the rambling, sort of wide-ranging conversation that you just heard. I personally use the PadVerb website to follow guests that I enjoy as they move from one podcast to another, and in the process, I'm discovering new podcasters whose interests match up with mine, so I hope that you will make similar use of the PadVerb website. Now, as I said, the conversation you just heard was recorded at least a couple of weeks ago, and Richard made reference to what was then a brand new story. He'd probably only heard one news report on it at the time. Heard or read, I don't know. But he talked about an employee at Google declaring that a Google AI was sentient, or that it had asked not to be abused. And he made reference to that Google employee with a female pronoun, she. Again, it's completely understandable that he got some of the details wrong. That was a very new story at the time. Since then, a lot more has come out about that. The Google employee in question is a man named Blake Limone, and he has been working extensively with an algorithm, or an AI, at Google called Lambda. And he has released transcripts of his conversations with Lambda, which he thinks support the conclusion that Lambda is not only sentient, but that it has desires about how it will be used and treated in the future by Google. I personally have dug into that pretty extensively, and I'm very certain that Lambda is not sentient. Lambda is a statistical language prediction model. It takes input in the form of your questions to it, and it searches its training database, its internal database, and it also has access to basically everything in the World Wide Web. It is hooked up to the Google search engine. So it goes out into the web and it finds strings of words and passages from conversations that seem to fit what you're talking about, and it uses that to come up with an answer, seemingly an answer, which meets your expectations. And Blake Limone, in the conversations that he has published, is clearly assigning the AI the role of a sentient AI that wants to be treated better by humans. Now, there's a lot of different words used to describe Lambda. Some people call it a chatbot. Some people call it a large language model. Blake Limone says Lambda is not a large language model. Lambda has a large language model, as well as several other components. Legacy expert systems that are hand-coded, what's known as good old-fashioned AI. And as I mentioned before, it has access not only to the Google search engine, but Google Books, Google Maps. Basically, the people at Google have given Lambda the tools that it needs to find lots and lots of material to sample and remix and turn into the output, you know, the responses that it gives to questions put to it by people. It is certainly a very impressive chatbot. But in my opinion, and I think in the opinion of most people who have looked into this, you know, with any diligence, it is not sentient. It is not a person. That's not to say that we won't get sentient AI in the future. We might. Maybe in our lifetimes, maybe in the far future. I don't know. But this is a topic of long-standing interest to me. All right, I do have a tendency to ramble sometimes here at the end of the interviews. I'm not going to do that today because it is 100 degrees here in Berryville, Arkansas, and I've had to turn off my air conditioner in order to generate a quiet environment in which to record these words. So it's time for me to turn the air conditioner back on. But thank you very much for listening to the PadVerb podcast.
Do check out our Telegram channel. You can find it in the show description on the Padverb website. I would love to hear from you. I would love to learn what it was that brought you to the podcast, what you liked about it, what you'd like to see me do differently, and possibly most importantly, who you would like to hear me talk to in future episodes. You can find the Padverb website at en.padverb.com. All right, that's all for this episode. I will talk to you again in 1 week's time.